So may I call Tony first to begin, please?
Thank you very much, Donald. I'll stand up so you can all see me. 10 minutes, you said.
Okay. 10 minutes.
Very telegraphically then. Mr. Putin is indeed back. It's perhaps worth recalling a little bit of the background to the election on Sunday. Of course, Russia has seen a huge upsurge in sort of civic activism and civic demonstrations against Mr. Putin and his regime, demands for more democratization, a more open government, less corruption, all of that. A crucial part of the background to the election. That led into the election itself, which produced a majority of 64% for Mr. Putin. As before, widespread allegations of fraud, a lot of them looking very plausible, and backed up by the international observers, who in my experience are rather cautious about saying this sort of thing. But I think the two important things to take away from the election. First of all, even if you discount for the fraud, which almost certainly took place, it seems very likely that Putin has the continuing support of about 50% of the Russian people. He is still the most significant and important and popular politician in Russia. And that is unsurprising, since in the eyes of many, many Russians, he is the man who brought them prosperity, stability, and a measure of national pride after the chaos of the Yeltsin years. But the second fact to take away from the election is that it was probably only 50%. The last election of President Medvedev, in effect in Putin's shadow, got 70%. And in the election before that, Putin got 70%. So you are looking at a majority, yes, but a very substantially eroded majority from what you might think of as the glory Putin-Medvedev years. Interesting question, as Donald says, is where do we go from here? And it seems to me that Mr. Putin has rather an important choice to make now. The straightforward approach, particularly in the light of the rhetoric of the election, is in effect to revert to business as usual, to carry on with the same ruling team, the same ruling techniques, to take the view that democracy may be all very well, but actually you know better what is good for Russia than anyone else does, and therefore it's important to stay in power, to continue to control the press, to allow, because such an authoritarian system necessarily does allow this, significant levels of corruption, and so on. That is one possible route. I've won. Russia wants me as I am. I will carry on in the way I was. The downsides of that are that, in the light of what has happened since September last year, that approach is visibly eroding. The loss of popularity is one example of it. The dropping off of various key officials from the system as it used to be. A judge saying, this is how Khodorkovsky was condemned. It's because we got the phone call from the Kremlin. Electoral officials saying, I was there when they falsified the ballots. I'm told, I need to check this story, but it sounds depressingly plausible, that in the upcoming Moscow municipal elections, the Yedinaya Rossiya official party candidates are all running again, but they're running now under their own names rather than labelled Yedinaya Rossiya. The official party itself has become such a tainted brand that people are edging away from it. So, yes, Putin deciding to go ahead as business as usual is possible, but it feels unstable and it feels on a downward course. This erosion is undoubtedly going to continue. He has lost significantly in popularity. He is losing people. One can imagine it leading to a very messy end sooner or later for the Putin regime as the level of protest, the level of resentment at the way Russia has been run for the last 12 years continues to boil over. His alternative approach is to look for compromise with the demonstrators, to look for things he can do which begin to open his system up. And there are odd, encouraging signs that this is beginning to happen. There are a couple of draft bills in front of the Duma now, one to make it easier for opposition parties to get registered, and another to reintroduce popular election of regional governors, which is something which Putin took away at an earlier stage. Astonishingly, 3 days ago, President Medvedev asked the public prosecutor to look again at the sentence which was passed down on Mikhail Khodorkovsky a few months ago. Now, this is astonishing because Khodorkovsky has been a real bête noire for the regime. The affirmations at the time that he was sentenced, that he was a total criminal, a total disaster for Russia, but he deserved the extra 8 years that he had got. To turn back on that would be a really remarkable U-turn and a really remarkable response to the sorts of attacks that the Putin regime has been subject to. Now, it's possible to be sceptical. A lot of what President Medvedev has done has not actually turned into action. Khodorkovsky, of course, is not the same threat now as he was before the election took place. And if you want to be really Machiavellian, if you look deeply conspiracy theories, conspiracy-minded theories about how Russia works, of course, Khodorkovsky out would not be an unalloyed good for the opposition. He's an oligarch. Most Russians hate him. He could be very useful to the people in power as being a hated figure who happens to be on the side of the reformers. Anyway, take it or leave it. The point is that there are odd signs there, and Putin and those around him are realistic men. They will inevitably have concluded that they need to move some distance to accommodate the demands of the demonstrators, and it will be very interesting to see, first in his initial appointments, and then in the way the government organises itself thereafter, quite how far they're willing to move in that direction. A key name to watch is Alexei Kudrin, former Minister of Finance, dropped out very early in order to involve himself, I won't say support, the demonstrators, a man who is convinced that current economic policies, which have been reinforced by a lot of extravagant Putin promises during the election, are not sustainable. If he comes back in, that will be a very good sign that at least rational economics are on the way back in. I've been going for, give me a couple of minutes on foreign policy and then I'll stop. What does all this mean for Russia's foreign policy? In the election campaign, Mr. Putin was stridently anti-Western. He has not been so strong, certainly in my experience of him. And a lot of people have rather overt, I think, with too much confidence, concluded that means we're in for an even rougher patch in Russo-Western relations than we have had so far. I think that's dubious. My experience of politicians in general is that they tend to say things in electoral campaigns which they often want to row back from afterwards. And as you look at the set of issues facing Russia in the post-electoral phase, you're looking at, roughly speaking, the same set of issues that Russia was dealing with before, and Russia's interests, of course, remain exactly the same. On the Middle East, the Arab Spring, on Syria, they have been very unhelpful. They vetoed the Security Council resolution earlier this year. And indeed, Putin has tried to distance himself slightly from Assad since then, but Russia is deeply averse to what they see as Western-sponsored overthrowing of rulers anywhere in the world, actually, but particularly in their patch, which they regard Syria as being, and I would expect Russia to remain on the whole supportive of Assad until that visibly becomes unsustainable. On the big crisis, which I suspect is coming up, Iran, actually, despite the press, Russia has on the whole been quite helpful to the international process. They have resisted us moving very fast. They're obviously, again, very resistant to Western military action, which obviously includes Israeli military action. But a key thing that they have done, which may be very significant in the coming months, is that they did not sell the Iranians their most advanced anti-aircraft rockets. That was under American encouragement, pressure, whatever you like to call it. And that could be really quite an important decision that they made in the forthcoming phase. On Afghanistan, they are actively, if quietly, being helpful. They are allowing shipments of military and other material across their territory because they are exactly as alarmed as we are by the prospect of Afghanistan falling back into Islamic fundamentalists. So we'll be dealing with a Russia with good aspects and bad aspects very much as we were before. One key dimension to this is that Russia going forward, its key task as viewed from inside is economic modernization. They have a one-dimensional economy. They have an economy under all sorts of pressures. It's growing quite well. They've got lots of reserves. But you can see things feel fragile. You could see it falling over any number of precipices. They need Western technology, Western investment, all of that to help them to modernize the economy in the way they want it. And they will be very careful not to endanger that in any way that they can. And in particular, I anticipate that they will work very hard to get themselves into the WTO, a decision virtually taken over the next few months. So, on foreign policy, I don't expect any huge changes, with one caveat. Foreign policy is very often a reflection of domestic pressures and actions. I am, as I said, reasonably sanguine that Russia will find a way through the current domestic political challenges. It is conceivable that the opposition, the tensions, the clashes domestically in Russia will get worse, in which case, being anti-Western could become a major political card for Mr. Putin. And in that case, who knows what the effect will be on foreign policy. But if we are dealing with a domestically unstable Russia, then we have all sorts of bigger problems than what they'll be doing externally. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony. I'm reminded of the American saying, a campaign platform is to run on and not to stand on. I hope you're right. Now, Anatol, please.
Thank you. Thanks very much for inviting me. I shall actually have to echo much of what Tony says, including the fact that I think he's demonstrated that the dreadful peril of spending too much time working on Russia over the years, you catch Machiavellianism. Because what you said about the possible reasons, you know, for releasing Trotsky was exactly what I was going to say.
Sorry,
I had precisely that suspicion myself that that was what it might be about. Anyway, the election results. Of course, Putin would have won anyway. If you look at opinion polls that we, at least in the past, have treated as reliable, like Levada, the actual vote for him would have been in the high 50s rather than the low 60s, perhaps, or a difference of 5 or 6%. That, it has to be said, is a very convincing win by Western standards. An interesting thing is that it's a very unconvincing win by post-Soviet standards. And that, not just the Central Asians, obviously, but even sort of quasi-would-be pretend democracies like Georgia and the Shevardnadze, you're looking at vastly higher results than that as a result of rigging. And I think that brings out something about Russia and the Russian population, but also perhaps the establishment and the regime itself, which is indeed that they are very unwilling to see themselves or feel themselves to being classified with the Central Asian dictatorships. Because fundamentally of this feeling that Russia is not like that, that Russia doesn't belong there, that Russia is, even if in Putin's phrase it is a third West or it's Eurasia, it is not simply a backward Asian country. That, I think, in turn leads to two conclusions. One is this is related to a growing fear, even if they don't talk about it very much in Russia, which is, of course, the fear of a rising China. And the fear that if Russia continues on its existing trajectory, including, of course, its economic trajectory, that it will end up inevitably as first an economic dependency, a provider of raw materials to China, but in the long run, a political dependency as well. That is something which, interestingly enough, though for different reasons, is a hateful idea both to liberals in Russia but also to conservatives, who after all believe in Russia as a great power, a pole of its own in the world. The second thing is that I believe that this has already, to some degree, and will in future, inhibit the regime from going down the path of really ruthless mass repression, which would once again classify them, you know, with the Uzbeks or whatever. I think that, you know, unless obviously they see the entire country falling to pieces, that they will back away from that and that whatever repression occurs will be on a completely more limited basis. Now, why did Putin get his majority? Well, of course, one reason, as has been much stressed in the Western media and quite rightly among commentators, is the way in which the entire system and above all the media were manipulated insofar, you know, so as to give him an overwhelming advantage when it came to winning over public opinion. But, and this one must also emphasise very strongly, because it hasn't been emphasised nearly enough in the Western media, is the fact that the opposition is, of course, deeply, deeply divided. It didn't, and as presently constituted, it cannot come up with a united anti-Putin candidate. Secondly, and therefore, you know, in those circumstances, naturally, the incumbent has a tremendous advantage. The second thing, however, is that if you look at the way the electorate does seem to have voted, and actually was likely to have voted with, of course, you know, as I say, some allowance for 5% or so rigging, it hasn't changed very enormously over time. New Russia, only in part. If you put together the vote for Putin, for Zhuganov, the communist, who, as always, since the end of the Soviet Union, has come second, as he always does, and Zhirinovsky, who I'm happy to say was beaten into third place this time, you still get a vote in excess of 80% of the electorate. Four forces which, in the broadest sense, can be described as either communist or whatever you call it by now, socialist, and nationalist, and or nationalist, or socialist and nationalist, if you look at the communists. Now, the liberal candidate who won in... Well, where did he win? Prokhorov? Won in London. Ain't quite the same thing as winning in Moscow, although he did do well in Moscow, but still only 20% or so. The point is, his vote, almost 8%, but remember, you'd have to multiply that by a completely incredible 600% before he could have a chance of actually winning in these elections. Now, that is worth remembering, because speaking as a former journalist myself, and I must confess I had these temptations too, but there is always the danger of falling into what I think we did see in some of the reporting of Egypt over the past year, which is to say, you go and talk to people who may indeed be the ones who are leading the demonstrations, in addition, are more likely to speak English. And without wishing to sound too cynical, if you're working for television, at least it is an advantage if they're young, female and attractive. You do not go out, and partly to be fair, because you don't have the time to get, you know, with the demonstrations raging and so forth, to go and talk to people in the suburbs, in the slums, in the countryside. And so in Egypt, we get a situation where, now this was quite widely predicted, the Muslim Brotherhood wins, but you also have an Islamist party which was simply never talked about in the Western media, which comes second with 25% of the vote. And, you know, there has been a tendency to do this in several countries. So, keep in mind, the overwhelming mass of the Russian electorate, there is no evidence that it is supportive of the kind of candidates who we favour in the West. For whatever set of reasons, I'll come to some of those reasons, a sort of civilised, modernising, social democratic alternative was actually beaten very badly indeed, just Russia and Sergei Mironov. And I think, you see, what this brings out is that any successful movement against Putin, given the basic attitudes of the Russian people, will have to have a strong nationalist element. It will have to have a social democratic element, or at least somewhere on the spectrum between social market economy and social democratic. And the problem is, of course, that Putin on the one side and the communists on the other have sucked much of the available atmosphere out of the air out of the atmosphere when it comes to building up such a movement. Where Putin is, of course, highly vulnerable and quite rightly, is to the accusations of corruption in his regime, and also of brutality, not just regime-mandated brutality, but the deep corruption brutality of the ordinary Russian police, not acting on state orders, but because they are so demoralised, badly paid, greedy, and so forth and so on. So, from that point of view, yes, I think one will see public anger with Putin continue. Where will it lead? Well, what obviously these protests have demonstrated is two things. I mean, one is that you, as you know, many of us have been predicting and hoping for a long time, you do now have middle classes in Russia which are not, as has been said so often in recent years, only interested in making money, you know, and just getting ahead in life. There is the growth of a certain idealism, or at least an exasperation with the way in which their aspirations are being held down by this corrupt state and state-linked oligarchy. And here one can see parallels with the rise of middle-class movements elsewhere in the past, going all the way back to the 19th century, you know, as middle classes come up. And they do have a capacity seriously to embarrass the regime. And as I said, I mean, Prokhorov only won in London, but he did do very well in Moscow. And of course, if you can mobilise 20% of the Muscovite population, assassination, you can do damage to the regime which is vastly in excess of your vote elsewhere in the country, because of course you can embarrass them on their doorstep in full sight of the media and so forth, unaware of it's happening in Nizhny Vartovsk or whatever. But once again, well, two things. One, the Liberals are not under their own steam going to win. Secondly, if you look at the actual ideology of some of the people who are at the heart of organising the demonstrations, well, they have some liberal aspects, but as we know from Navalny, they also have aspects which are profoundly illiberal. There is certainly no evidence, as far as I can see, that a future Russian government will in fact, as you say, differ significantly when it comes to foreign policy. That will take place within a narrow band. And I agree as well. I mean, what's interesting is that Putin obviously thought that he could win a measure of public support by taking this anti-Western line, but I don't think this will be reflected in policy. Changes in policy, at least in the short term, will depend far more on what the West does. First and foremost, of course, the question of an Israeli attack. As to hopeful scenarios, well, as has widely been written, I think we can reasonably hope that Putin will make this his last term. I certainly hope so, that he will not be willing to go through this again, that he will start thinking about how to hand over to a successor. The hope, I think, must be then that, yes, I mean, progressive elements in the regime will start to reach out to people in the opposition in order to try and defuse some of the present anger and simply to try to improve government performance, both in terms of economic reform and closely linked to that, corruption. But as I say, this will not in and of itself represent democratization in Russia or a triumph for the opposition because at present that is not what a majority of the opposition is actually about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. John, please.
Thank you very much.
I just say there is a place, I think.
I have the unenviable task of having to do a little bit of sweeping up, as it were, at the end and find pieces that people haven't talked about so much. For better or for worse, I find myself largely in agreement with what has been said, but let me just put my views on the table. Firstly, I think that Putin is now a somewhat diminished figure. His system has entered a period of what it seems to me is existential crisis, with an important part of society, what they call in Russia this creative class, seemingly alienated from what Putin stands for and what he offers, part of society that was up until quite recently politically apathetic. This is significant. But I would say this is both a problem for Putin and a potential opportunity if he is to use it. Putin has been called in Russia for many years the Teflon president. He seemed to be immune from so many of the things besetting the country and to maintain these remarkable levels of what is described as popularity in Russia, which Anatole has rightly qualified. But it seems that he has lost his Teflon. I'd also say that his return to the Kremlin is a sign not of the system's strength, but indeed of its weakness and its difficulty in being able to reproduce or to sustain itself. Medvedev was either never intended to succeed Putin. I personally don't buy the theory that it was all stitched up 4 years ago. I think he was given a chance, but he didn't inspire sufficient confidence in the ruling elite to become a real standalone president. So we have this system that is extremely dependent on one individual. Putin ran not as a representative of United Russia, the ruling party, or indeed his hastily created Popular Front. He ran as Vladimir Putin, and that creates for him, I think, very major vulnerabilities if things start to go wrong. He faces undoubtedly a crisis of legitimacy in both Moscow and St. Petersburg. As Anatole said, Prokhorov did remarkably well in Moscow. Some people even think that he might have won. I haven't seen any evidence for that. But what we should keep in mind here is that this vast, ramshackle country, the Russian Federation, lives at different speeds, depending where you are. There are bits of it that are in the 21st century, bits in the 20th century, and other bits that are in the 19th century, if not in times before. So it's very difficult for us analysts to read what is really happening in Russia, because it depends what you're talking about, and it depends on whether events in Moscow are so significant for perhaps events in the industrial heartland that are living in a slightly different age. I agree with Tony that the regime will react, I think, with some measures to let off steam. Those could include letting out Khodorkovsky. I tend to think that this is actually somebody who's acquired immense moral stature in Russia through simply not being broken by that system. He's behaved throughout with great honour, and he could yet play a role in the development of this country. I see, in addition to the political measures, some reformist economic policies being enacted. I certainly agree that the return of Alexei Kudrin, the previous finance minister, could make life interesting. And it could give a brief impression of some regenerated energy, creativity, and a new cycle of reforms. This would be a very effective way of co-opting those liberals who don't really know which side they're on at this stage. I would be very surprised if there is a real effort to turn the screw and reduce media freedoms, control the internet and lock up the leaders of the non-systemic opposition. This is not Belarus, and I don't think that Russia is going down that track. Is this enough for Putin to maintain his popularity, maintain a degree of legitimacy? Maybe, maybe not. I would qualify it by saying the ruling elite to me looks tired. You've got very few new people coming through. There could be some more jostling within this ruling group. Another factor of unpredictability. Do they think that Putin can actually no longer carry the water? They need to look for another replacement. Russia tends not to work in a very linear way. With regard to the opposition, let us first of all say it is embryonic. I think we may be seeing a new form of opposition being created, those people who haven't been politically active before. Navalny, a relatively recent figure to appear, a new generation. Will the demonstrations in Moscow be able to keep going? Possibly, but I think there's some signs that they're already losing steam. But what we should not forget, and this was explained to me recently by a journalist watching these events in the regions, that there is going to be some very interesting things happening in the regions in terms of elections, if this bill is enacted that Tony was describing, for the more competitive elections being restored for governors, admittedly in a somewhat controlled way. But does this mean that the opposition then actually takes its campaign to the regions of the country? There is a mayoral election going on in the not insignificant city of Yaroslavl, close to Moscow, which has gone to a second round and where there is an independent candidate who could win. So this could all have some sort of boomerang effect on Moscow as well. But I think it's fair to say that a significant degree of unpredictability remains in Russia, but this is not the USSR in the late 1980s. This is a very different country, but there are certainly signs of what Gorbachev described in those days as pre-existing crisis. A counterthesis, perhaps, to all this is that Russia has a remarkable opportunity for reform. You've got pressure from a vital part of society. Can Russia now build more effective institutions, finally resolve the issue of property rights, and put in place a set of reforms to move the country forward very much in the manner of Alexander II after the Crimean War? Putin would like to think so. He's used some of the language, indeed, from those days. But in making this argument, what is difficult to sustain it, at least, is, well, what has Putin and his team, what have they been doing over the last 8 years? Why did they let this opportunity slip through their fingers? Where I think the issues really are going to be decided, and we've talked a little less about this today, are in the economy. I don't see any major short-term problems. We have a high oil price, which could still go higher because of Iran. We have a budget, therefore, in Russia, which is set to balance, despite the somewhat extravagant now social spending that's about to be put into force. And we have a Russian economy that has also reduced its exposure to disruptions of global capital markets. The Russians had a very bad moment at the end of 2008, and I think there was some incipient panic, in fact, in the ruling elite when oil prices plunged to $40 and below. Because I think if oil goes down to $60, Russia's got some really, really serious problems, because the budget's going to be balancing at around $120 at the current rate. So the economy's still disproportionately exposed to the oil price. This is a very, very serious problem. I think Russia is undoubtedly, and this is a factor they cannot control, the risk of exposure to prolonged crisis in the Eurozone, which will affect markets for Russian goods. It will depress the prices for commodities, and it will lower the levels of foreign investment, European investment in particular, in Russia. In recent years, capital investment has been on the very low side. We've seen over the last 12 months through 2011 into this year, increasing capital flight from Russia of the order of over $80 billion in 2011. We've seen an exodus, and I think a continuing exodus, of good people. When I worked in Russia in the 90s, there was this joke that Russia was a country of optimists, and you were supposed to ask why. And the answer was that all the pessimists had left. And it does occasionally feel like that. Demographics, another factor that Russia cannot easily control or influence. The size of the labour force is shrinking. Labour productivity is very low. Philip Hansen, my colleague at Chatham House, has calculated this, in fact, below under 45% of the level of Germany's labour productivity. Education, again, another big problem. Russia's not delivering quality education in the way it should. In 2010, according to one authoritative educational ranking, only one Russian university was in the top 200 universities in the world. That's Moscow State University, if anybody's wondering which one. So you've got all these factors, the continuing inefficiencies and barriers created by preserving this non-competitive system. In Russia, the word sistema, it has a certain connotation. This is a set of informal rules and procedures which are designed to benefit a key group of business people and officials, characterized by a strong fusion of power and property. So to protect this system, you have an unreliable judicial system, you have hideous forms of corporate raiding and other practices that are totally incompatible with developed markets. So how Russia breaks out of this cycle, I don't think, is very clear to many of us. Can I just say on the foreign policy front, I would just echo the point of two words, that the anti-Americanism, very much there in Putin's campaign speeches and his article on foreign policy, but it's been there a lot of the time over the last 10 years. And you think back to 2007, the Bucharest summit, where he gave the West a lecture. It's there, everybody knows it, there are no surprises. I think what I would add to this now is Putin he was horribly spooked by what happened in Ukraine in 2004 in the Orange Revolution. This has been a sort of recurring nightmare for him. And then seeing events in the Arab world and concluding that social media, internet, and other forces were making societies less controllable, this is something that clearly, clearly bothers him. And for the moment, he's saying the US and other Western countries are trying to usurp the human rights agenda. That's the word he uses. and use it as an instrument of pressure against Russia. So I think the new American ambassador is probably going to continue to have a difficult time for the moment. Syria, I think, is going to be something of a litmus test to see how closely Russia sticks to the Chinese line. Russia is very worried about the long-term relationship with China, as Anatole has said. But I think in a way, Syria is, Russia sees this as some sort of dress rehearsal for what might happen with Iran. And again, as this paranoia about possible regime change. So the reset with the United States is undoubtedly going to come under pressure. But I don't see that Putin wants to torpedo this relationship. Just because it isn't friendly, particularly friendly, doesn't mean it has to be totally uncooperative. At the end of the day, Russia needs the United States to balance China. So to conclude, I think we need to continue to watch Russia very closely. A lot's going to happen over the next 6 years. Not clear to me that Putin is going to survive that term at all. Our expectations need to be realistic, both our pessimistic expectations sometimes and our optimistic ones. It's very difficult sometimes to find this balance in looking at Russian affairs. My general sense is that Russia will continue to steer between what can be called stagnation plus, on the one hand, the more optimistic scenario, stagnation minus, on the other hand, but without a decisive breakdown or indeed breakthrough.